Okay, I hope everybody can find a seat in this room. The other room was a little bit crowded, but it was a nice, closer-knit environment to talk in. So if you have questions, you're going to have to project them out and let me know. And I think they're recording this, so you may want to use one of these microphones. What I'm going to do is try to connect a bit to the theme of the CIDR program, which is going on this summer, which is deformation of the deep earth. But try to find an aspect of that which hasn't received much attention during that workshop, but is also of general interest. I don't know about low temperature universe levels of interest in deep earthquakes, but I'll try to make it accessible at the risk of making some of my earth science colleagues a little bit impatient for me to get along to some interpretation. I'm going to lay some foundations, make sure everybody has sufficient background to kind of appreciate the challenge and enigma of understanding deep earthquakes, which are, I'm not going to be able to conclude with a comprehensive understanding of these events. And I'll tell you why and try and give you some sense for what we think should or shouldn't happen in the earth versus what is actually happening in the earth. Okay, well, let me start very simplistically to get you calibrated to earthquakes. Okay, earthquakes need to be understood in a very general fashion before we can delve into the deep earth manifestation of earthquakes, which is, as we'll see, kind of hard to understand. And the way to start is very simplistically with simple physics experiments, laboratory experiments that have been conducted for many years, where you put materials into, take an experimental chunk of rock and you squeeze on it and you measure when it breaks. Okay, that's a straightforward thing to do. You can put a degree of confining pressure on it. You can do this experiment at different pressures. You can measure with some deviatoric stress, as long as these stresses are dominant, these are minor. You will introduce deviatoric stresses within the system, and you can measure the deformation system up to the point where it breaks. And of course, in earth materials at kind of ambient surface conditions, everything behaves a little bit elastically and it'll strain with linear deformation up to a point at which it will fracture. And that's been well mapped out. And what's been found is summarized as a result of many experiments in these kind of uniaxial compression, where you find domains where, as we increase sigma 1, the normal stresses squeezing on the rock, versus the resolved shear stresses on surfaces in the rock that form either as it breaks and shears, or maybe pre-existing surfaces that you put at different orientations and squeeze on until it slides frictionally. And we can measure what is the relationship between the applied shear stress, the applied normal stress, the confining stress, and the point at which it fails. And this has been measured to give numbers like tau proportional to sigma 1, and going up to 0.6 sigma 1 plus, say, 50 MPa, for values going out to about 2,000 MPa, okay, which will correspond to depths in the Earth 50, 60 kilometers deep. And it's just measured that you will get shear stresses that lead to failure. Kind of, this is just what it takes to get that rock to break. And this has been found to be pretty ubiquitous for any type of rock. Granite, basalt, take different rocks of different material properties or different compositions, and they all have this kind of failure criterion. And we call this Byerly's law. Okay? And it frames a lot of our thinking that, well, that's the strength of rocks. Accompanying that, we can say then that in the Earth, as the pressure, the stresses applied to the medium increase with depth, the strength of rocks should increase with depth. Okay, so if we go down into the Earth with depth now, along which pressure is increasing, and plot the anticipated strength of rock as a function of depth, it's going to increase, maybe with some kinks in it, but going to increase with depth. And you think, well, it could just keep getting stronger, except something else is happening inside the Earth, not captured in these experiments, which are usually at the same room temperature, which is that the temperature is increasing with depth. And as temperature increases, you get above about 600 degrees centigrade, it activates deformation mechanisms within the rock that can allow the movement of dislocations, the movement of reconstruction of the crystal lattice that allows it to deform without fracturing. So that we find as a function of depth that there are activation of these mechanisms that varies exponentially with depth that will eventually intersect the intrinsic frictional strength of materials to cause a transition to ductile deformation where you will not have fracture, but you'll have flow. Okay, so that could happen in this medium if we confine it sufficiently and squeeze it. It will not necessarily fracture, but can just plastically deform. And so this is the temperature bound, and it's going to the intersection of this with this extrapolated strength profile. It's going to define kind of the domain in which we have brittle failure in the Earth. Okay, so let me put some numbers on this. This would be, for example, going, I don't know, about 750 up to maybe 1500 MPa, which you're going to have that type of behavior. Okay, transition. And this does depend on the type of rock. If it's granites and continental rocks or more mafic materials out in oceanic rocks, you will have different kind of weakening processes. So that granites will begin to soften at shallower depth than pyritites or olivine minerals, more mafic minerals that exist in the mantle below. It also depends on whether it's dry or wet. And I've drawn sort of a dry curve, and if it were wet, water will make materials weaker. Okay? And that's going to be, so let me just note that, because we'll refer back to these little basic curves. And then granites, this might be around 25 kilometers depth into the Earth where you get these pressures, and this kind of range over here would be 50 kilometers or so for granite, and let's call this pyritite, just an olivine-rich assemblage like you might have in the upper mantle. Okay? So basically, we should have earthquakes down to 25 kilometers in granitic-rich rocks, the continents. That's what you see. 80% of the world's seismicity is shallower than these levels. Continents, it's shallower. In Southern California, you don't find earthquakes going down to 700 kilometers. I'm going down to 25 kilometers. That's controlled by the strength of granite as a function of depth and this intersection of increasing pressure effect, increasing temperature effect, defining the bound in which you can have brittle failure as a dominant mechanism rather than a plastic ductile deformation. Oceanic environments and some continental environments where you have sufficient stress to activate faulting in the upper mantle, down below the crust, you can get down to 50 kilometers. Okay? That's about it. That's what you expect.
Yeah. Usually, think of earthquakes as being due to applied shear stress, which you haven't addressed at all.
Well, in that system, there are shear stresses. That's a good segue point for what's the relationship between the deviatoric stresses in that system and shear stress. So we could plot as a function of normal stress and shear stress. For that system, say, would have some values of sigma 1 and sigma 3 in normal stresses. And if you took a little cube, well, let's just take that surface, we'll make it simple, and you change the orientation of the surface around relative to the direction of sigma 1, the vertical direction, you can determine by the transformation of the stress tensor into a different coordinate system as it rotates within a fixed stress environment, how much shear stress there would be and how much normal stress, such that if you're at this point, you would have a corresponding amount of shear stress and normal stress resolved for a orientation defined by this angle, this is 2 theta, where theta would end up being the angle here between the direction of the principal stress and the direction of the surface that ruptures. So shear stress is predictably related to the deviatoric normal stresses by this. This is called Mohr's circle. And this is very, you know, if you think back to your long ago mechanical engineering, they would have introduced this as a depiction of tensor transformation in the presence of some stress field. Okay, Mohr's circle is useful because we can combine that with this, the same plot, shear stress versus normal stress, and define some curve in here based on Byerly's law, which is the stress it takes to break the rock. You say, well, how do I get the stress in my system to break the rock? You can squeeze it more, increase sigma 1, keep sigma 3 the same, and what that does is makes bigger circles because you keep pushing sigma 1, right? And that will increase the shear stresses on certain planes with certain orientations in that system up to the point, well, I didn't quite get there. Let's try to hit it. But we kiss the curve, and at that point, you will then have an associated normal stress and a shear stress that causes the breakage of the rock. Or if you had a pre-existing fault, sliding of the rock. You'll exceed the frictional strength. Okay, so that means that we can put together the idea of Mohr's circle with this. So let me just put some numbers. This was I'll do it in MPa, 50 MPa. That curve, that Byerly laws curve, and that increase in deviatoric stress. Okay, we're almost there. All we have to add to this before we go into the deep earth is there's another way to get this to break, which is to wet it a bit. If you wet it, you put water or some other fluid component into that, the water can go into little cracks that form. When you squeeze the material under this system, you produce little extensional cracks, okay, that are orthogonal to the direction of the minimum principal stress, or parallel with the direction of the biggest principal stress. You open up little cracks. And it's from these little cracks opening up and having stress concentrate their edges, eventually they will produce a through-going fault at a geometry which is determined by this Mohr circle intersection with the curve, which gives, for example, for this stress state, that angle theta be this angle here. Okay? So you actually, to get rock to fracture, you make a bunch of little fractures that are not aligned with the direction of the ultimate through-going surface, but they'll be aligned with respect to the principal stress axes, and then they will connect up. Okay, and this is observed, kind of the microphysics of fracturing rock. So, anything else I need to do? I think that allows us to go on. Ah, you're right. I kind of forgot to get back to that. If these little cracks, which in the very low pressure condition, be open up and there'd be an air-filled crack. If there's water, and it can migrate into those cracks, okay, that water then can support part of the pressure of the system. The common part of this isotropic part of this is pressure. And it can reduce the mean normal stress in a fashion that will simply translate you to a new effective stress by subtracting off pore water pressure in fluid-filled cracks. Okay? What could that do? If you had this system here with this kind of average pressure and you wet it, you can move this whole circle to the left until it intersects the failure criterion. Okay, so pore pressure moves the Mohr circle in the direction toward the failure criterion, because part of the normal stress, which is giving strength to the rock, is going into the fluid confinement, which does not kind of play a major role in the initiation of the cracking. It simply reduces the effective stress in the system. Okay, so if you're wet, you'll be able to fail more readily. Okay, so this is the effect of water or any other fluid. We'll call it H2O. I'll try and find the chalk here. Was there a question back there? Well, in a sense, but I mean, everything is sort of connected together. The friction law itself is the evolution of this network of cracks into a through-going failure and then progressive sliding on it. Whether you're wet and you have fluid on the crack that forms or within these interstitial normal extensional cracks, it's all kind of combined together. And you can try to develop a sophisticated constitutive law for that, but we typically simply rely on empirical guidelines to get the net effect. In detail, of course, now there's a lot of specialists here that could go into greater detail about what's happening in the crystal deformation process, but we don't have to worry about that for the moment. Okay, so that's the rock mechanics stuff. Let's start with some observations. Now, as I said, this behavior, the shallow rocks of the Earth are wet. The strength increases pretty much as indicated by this curve. Spec shallow earthquakes, wetting it just makes them more viable. When earthquakes occur in the shallow Earth, they drop stress much, much less than the strength of rock suggested here that says something's playing a really big role in reducing the shear stresses required to fail relative to intact rock strength. So we might have typical stress drops of 1 or 2, 3 MPa occurring in domains where the ambient stresses are 100 MPa. Very small fraction of the available absolute stress goes into earthquake failure. Okay, so early days, people noticed that the rocks of the Earth are mainly varying just with depth in terms of their elastic properties, the speed of sound, for example. And if you have a shallow earthquake and you have a bunch of stations deployed in an area, you'll see that that earthquake produces waves that sweep past those stations with a very systematic pattern of increasing time to get to further away stations that's controlled by the speed of sound going through the rock. Okay? So if you had a station right here, right above an earthquake, very rare, see the first signal from this sound wave emitted as the Earth is fracturing, it's rupturing, you're sliding rock on rock, it's like screeching breaks, emitting sound into the surrounding rock, gets here first, further away, it takes longer for the sound to get there. Depends on the velocity of the sound. Simple idea. And so the travel time versus distance, it's like that, with the slope of that curve indicating the velocity of sound in the rock. Well, people began to put out instruments around, well, beginning in the 1870s, but in Japan by 1910, 1920, they had a lot of instruments around them. And they saw this effect, and you could calibrate the velocity of sound in the shallow crust very well, around 6 kilometers per second. Sometimes, though, what they observed in the 1920s, they've got well-calibrated knowledge of the speed of sound and rock, was that as a function of distance, they saw this type of behavior. instead of being minimum right at the position above the source and then linearly increasing with distance, it was very flat over a broad area. In other words, the time for the wave to get to you was about the same over a wide area. And the way to explain that is to put the earthquake deeper so that its time at which it gets to this station are much closer together than if they're just spreading horizontally. Simple idea. Triangulate back to find the source. It has to be deep. This gets more and more pronounced the deeper you go. And they found that some sources had to be as deep as 700 kilometers into the Earth, which means that the wave is coming up almost flat across a wide area of the surface of the Earth, and you feel the shaking. You hear the sound almost the same time over a very wide area. Okay, no other way to explain this other than to have deep earthquakes. So once they recognized this, they began to count. They said, how often do such events happen? Most earthquakes are going to happen shallow, but we think there's some weird events happening deeper, and they're going to violate all the expectations from rock physics. How often they happen? So you count them. And you could count, for example, a lot of them. We'll plot it in a logarithmic scale because lots of earthquakes. We'll plot that as a function of depth into the Earth. 0 to 700 kilometers deep. Okay? Just count the number of earthquakes. Relying on this very robust observation that some are occurring deep, and what you find is that in the upper, I'm going to draw some critical depths, 70 kilometers, you find the number of earthquakes logarithmically very big in the upper 70 kilometers. And Gutenberg and Richter called this shallow. Earthquakes above 70 kilometers, shallow earthquakes. They're all going to be more or less consistent with the expectation of Byerly's law, strength of rock increasing, some variation because of thermal variations in the between the oceans and the crust. From 70 down to 300, they called these intermediate depths. Okay? And to give you some kind of numbers, we have to pick some magnitude thresholds. I'll say MB5 and larger. Magnitude is strength of the earthquakes based on how strong the ground shaking is. It's a logarithmic scale. So magnitude 6 is going to shake the ground 10 times more strongly than magnitude 5. If we count all the events bigger than magnitude 5 from when we have a complete catalog of such events, we'll go to 2016. Okay, every one of these earthquakes, we can determine their existence on the Earth, their magnitude, their depth. We can actually determine their faulting geometry for everything above this size throughout this period of time. And you get these numbers, and the number here would be around 10 per year per kilometer of depth. I think that's a good number. Is that right? Yeah. 10 earthquakes per year per kilometer of depth. So if you go down 70 kilometers, that's about 700 magnitude 5 earthquakes per year. But then it drops off exponentially. Yeah. Yeah, they had developed very good models for the velocity as a function of depth, and they're able to get the accurate determinations of this effect, how much the wave has spread. Okay, that was sort of a bootstrapping process of calibrating the Earth from shallow to deeper, but was pretty well nailed down even by 1920 when the first deep earthquakes were reported. They were confident. And, you know, their uncertainties were perhaps 10 or 15 kilometers in depth, which is not much different than today. Okay, so that's an interesting curve. Exponential decrease in intermediate depth activity, it almost stops. You think, well, there's some process that is either shifting around more circle, maybe fluids could do that to allow earthquakes to occur at much higher stresses than you would think, or something's going on. And it'd be kind of nice if they just died and went away. We might be able to interpret that. But then they come back. And what's even more perplexing about that, and I should put some more tick marks on this. This is down to 0.1 per year, per kilometer. Okay, so this is logarithmic. By the time you're down to 300 kilometers, you barely have any events occurring annually there at all. Looks like the process has just died away. But then it comes back and it comes up to, you know, several events per year. Not a huge amount, but another interesting aspect of those earthquakes is that they can be very big. In fact, the biggest events happen in the depth range, well, let's say 600 to 680. And some of these earthquakes that count as one in this counting are magnitude 8 giant earthquakes, bigger than any earthquake we've had in California ever, occurring with 600 kilometers of rock on top of them, squeezing them down so that you should be way, way, way over here, right? The stresses should be incredibly big to make Mohr circle big enough to intersect the failure curve, unless you do something to weaken the rock. Fluids, we know, could shift it to the left, compensate for those huge compressive stresses, or something exotic, something different than is happening in shallow, brittle failure, which is what we identify with Byerly's law. Okay, so 1920s, they had the first indication of this, and it caused kind of great doubt about seismology for a while. They said, oh, it must be wrong. Can't be these deep earthquakes because mechanically it cannot happen. There were very emphatic rock physicists. And I would have probably agreed with them other than the seismology was as simple as I've described. It's very hard to spoof. As long as you have good station, good timing. Japan had a lot of stations, so Wadati was the person who did most of this discovery work. Okay, well, let me add one more thing before I go on, which is kind of the number of events. So if you count all the events bigger than magnitude 5, a magnitude 5 earthquake with modern instruments we could detect everywhere on the surface of the Earth. It sends sound waves through the Earth big enough to see, as well as S waves, elastic waves. 78% of all the events in this time frame, that magnitude bigger than 5, occur in the upper 70 kilometers. So Byerly laws worked for about 80% of all the earthquakes. They aren't too mysterious. They're complicated, and I spent a lot of time trying to understand any one of them. But they basically make sense as brittle failure within the cold, low-temperature environment in the surface thermal boundary condition, because they're above this region where temperatures increase enough to cause ductal deformation to dominate. And what is it? It's, I'll say 17% in this range. And down here, a lowly 6%, okay? So in the annual budget then, of how many deep earthquakes, 300 to 700 kilometers deep, occur around the world, it's only 6%, 6 out of every 100. But some of them are magnitude 8s. And none of them are easily attributable to frictional sliding rock failure because of the huge confining pressure. And the curious suggestion that whatever process allows earthquakes to get this deep drops off exponentially with depth, and something else kicks in. Okay. All right, so they were stuck with this, and there are great papers in the 1930s analyzing this. They had this information, and they're just puzzled as hell. What's the explanation for these? Well, things don't really get much better until the plate tectonics stage comes in and provides an explanation for some of these events. Now, I should say, where are they geographically found? They're not found everywhere. 99% of the Earth's regions, 500 kilometers deep, have no earthquakes. They only occur in concentrated belts of deep activity in the Western Pacific margins, along the Eastern Pacific margin between below South America. There's some under Spain. Who would have thought? There's a deep earthquakes under Spain. And they're geographically very restrictive, but they're also kind of somehow linked to where intermediate depth earthquakes occur, because these occur in the same regions, okay, intermediate and deep. The 1960s brought about plate tectonics, the recognition that there is oceanic lithosphere kind of created at some ridge. You form a thin layer of basalt by melting. And eventually this founders, gets cold and sinks. And I assume that most people are familiar with plate tectonics, upwellings, producing melting, decompression melting, forming a basaltic layer, somewhat depleted residual we call Hertzbergite, and it ages at the surface of the Earth for typically 100 million years, gets colder and denser, cooling off, and then it sinks spontaneously as best we can tell. And that material that has been at the Earth's surface and gotten very cold gets down to 600 kilometers at on the order of 10 million years. Okay, so I get down to here, 10 to 15 million years. Okay, having cooled off at the surface for 100 million years, all the time developing a nice thermal boundary layer with conduction of heat out of the surface, cooling that rock down, making it very happily in the stiff, low temperature environment where brittle failure can happen. But if you look at where are earthquakes in these oceanic lithosphere, they're confined, all of them, to above 70 kilometers. In fact, they're pretty well mapped out by a particular temperature. Oh, that was pleasant. That's about 600 degrees. You don't find earthquakes below 600 degrees, because they get above that, the ductile mechanisms dominate. Okay? You just don't have brittle failure. So if we draw that 600 degree isotherm, constant temperature, it's about halfway through the thickened thermal boundary layer, which may go down to around 1200 degrees, all of which is transporting because it's low enough temperature that it's stiff and it moves together as a plate, giving plate tectonics, seafloor spreading, so where you're generating the plates. Subduction zones are where the plates go down. Subduction zones are where you're going to have intermediate and deep focus earthquakes. Okay, so clearly they're associated with bringing cold material down. That helps. But it's still kind of amazing it could overcome this. But because you can get this material to sink quite quickly, it's able to get low temperature material deep enough before it conductively warms up that you can stay in the brittle regime somehow. Okay, so this is the isotherm within the plate. There's still some heat flowing in from either side of this. If we look at the isotherm on the other side, material gets entrained and pulled down with the sinking slab, and you actually depress this isotherm on this side by advectively dragging down material that was colder, goes down viscously coupled to this sinking plate, and you get that type of internal isotherm. And if you picked a lower number, 400, you'd have something that might terminate around here. If you picked 800, you might be able to get it down to 670 or 700 kilometers. Below 700 kilometers, no deep earthquake has ever been detected in the Earth, confidently. Might have been one or two candidates. Okay. Well, this is still cold. I mean, this is 600 degrees. It's surrounded by rock that is, you know, over 1,500 degrees. It's just sluggishly conducting in. Okay, and they had lots of time to give up heat here and cool down from, you know, 1,400 degree mantle to this cold material. Now, if you look at where the earthquakes are, the earthquakes happen, lots of them, right on this boundary, where these two plates are rubbing against each other. Lots within the crust, down to about 200 or 300 kilometers. Those are intermediate depth. Some are happening within the sinking oceanic plate. They kind of die off. There's very few. There's not really a systematic pattern. And then they're going to pick up, include very big events down there. Okay? Which is just weird, right? Why are they coming back? So what we have to do is we have to put this into a, we have a thermal context, but we also put it into a petrological context. I said this stuff is basalt. That's probably invisible. And this stuff could be Hartzberg I. It's just peridotite taking out the basalt component. As it goes down, the deeper part of the slab is mainly made of the phase olivine. It's the most common upper mantle mineral, probably constitutes about 60% of the volume of the mantle, MgFe2SiO4. Very stable. But as it goes down, it's going to higher and higher pressures and slowly to higher and higher temperatures. And when you get down to depth of 400 kilometers, olivine will go through a phase transformation that occurs at shallower depth in the colder material. Probably exaggerated that a bit. Okay. Where olivine, that's why I hate writing on the board, goes to beta spinel or sometimes called Wadsleyite. It's a solid state phase transition which reorganizes the crystal. It doesn't change the chemistry, doesn't change the stoichiometry. The MgFe2SiO4 stays the same, but you reorganize it, the lattice, to a denser form. Okay? That occurs at lower temperature, at lower pressure, so it should be elevated in the slab under equilibrium conditions. You keep taking it down, and Wadsleyite, around this depth, around 510, transforms to another form of Mg2SiO4, ringwoodite. Still the same mineral stoichiometry, but a denser form, around 510. And finally, when you get down to 670, olivine will turn to a form of perovskite, magnesium perovskite, that we now call bridgmanite, plus some ferropericlase, or FeMgO. It's hard to read my scribbles, I'm sorry. FeMgO. Okay, now this is expected to happen. And we can do this, we can take olivine, squeeze it in the laboratory at these pressures at 410, 500, 660, you'll go through olivine to wadsleyite to ringwoodite to perovskite or bridgmanite. Phase transitions will happen. It's got to happen to the sinking slab. And that's obviously very interesting because the correspondence of where you have these big earthquakes and the correspondence to these phase changes suggests that there may be some sort of mechanism that could account for how you overcome 600 kilometers of squeeze. Okay? And what may have been complete loss of any water at shallower depth. Well, let me talk a little bit about water.
What's the density change you're talking about, Brad?
These are a few percent, 5% type of change. Smaller for wadsleyite to ringwoodite, bigger here. So there's a little density increases, okay? But significant. That would make this material more dense than the surrounding material. That will help to pull the plate down. Here you've got less dense material pushing down into deeper material. It's going to resist, and it's going to cause stress that resists the sinking of the slab. And that's going to play an important part in deep earthquakes. The last thing I've got to add to our cartoon before I talk about mechanisms that cause these earthquakes is what happens to water. We know that in the shallow plate, in order to make these bends, the plate fractures. Yes, there are big subduction zone thrust events right on the plate boundary. That's the biggest earthquakes in the world. But you don't get 100 kilometer thick, and this is about to scale, 100 kilometer thick thermal boundary layer to do a 30 to 45 or 90 degree bend without internal deformation. And you get earthquakes up here that could be on either dipping toward the direction of subduction or away from it. And you get lots of fracturing of the basaltic crust. And into those fractures, water is circulating. Now, water has been circulating in the basaltic crust since every part of its journey. It's very fractured near the ridge, a lot of hydrothermal circulation. Some of that water is probably getting into the subcrustal upper mantle of this Hertzbergite. We don't quite know how much water is getting down here, but when you break here in what can be magnitude 8 events, it's thought that you can get a lot of water in. Okay? It's right before it sinks. So then what you're sending down into the mantle is a hydrated, shallow part of this sinking lithospheric slab. Now water can move that Mohr circle around. Okay? It's thought that most of this water, when it goes down, is not going to stay as liquid water. Some of that will quickly squeeze out like a sponge going to higher pressure. But much of it will react with the minerals to make hydrous versions of the minerals that are stable over limited pressure temperature regimes, so that in the basaltic crust, you could have minerals like chlorite or jadeite. It depends on the specific pressure temperature profile, which is different for every subduction zone, as to what minerals happen. We have a lot of hydrous phases that suck up water and hold it, but they're not particularly stable. As they go to higher and higher pressure, they lose their water. And in particular, this Hertzbergitic layer forms antigerite versions of serpentine. So it's got water in it as well, and it's going down. You got a lot of a whole variety of hydrous phases in the very wet crust, squeezing in the higher and higher pressure, and the mineral physicists have been exploring the stability of those hydrous phases, finding at various pressures from 70 kilometers down, they go unstable, they break apart, and leave the non-hydrous version plus free water. Free water squirts out as you go through those changes, can fill these cracks. If you suddenly wet the system of little cracks that are forming, fill them with water that reduce the pore pressure, you can get the system, even though you're going to higher and higher pressure, the pore pressure brings you back and allows failure. And this is the domain where all these hydrous phases are going down of what we call generically, or at least we used to call it, fluid-assisted faulting. It's nothing new. We think that it happens in the shallow earth everywhere. It's water in the shallow crust that's helping to reduce the stresses. But we think that its flushing of water out of hydrous phases is enabling it to also produce earthquakes deeper into the mantle than would otherwise be possible. Remember, there's no earthquakes over here. No earthquakes over here. It's only in the cold, wet conditions where you can get them. And we also know you have to be cold, because a lot of that water flushes out into the mantle and precipitates melting. You add water and melting's easier. That makes the dye appear as they come up into volcanoes. But that's almost aseismic. So just adding the water to the surrounding mantle, still too hot for it to fail brittly, still ductally deforming. You got to have the combination of low temperature and hydrous conditions to make the earthquakes. But it's a one-way process. Every bit of water that gets out of these hydrous phases leaves dry stuff behind that cannot fail. So it's thought that this progressive depletion of water sources accounts for this. This exponential drop-off can be inferred as an indicator of how much water is flushing out of the system and being lost, and once it's gone, you're kind of stuck. You're going to have to deform ductally under the pressures and temperatures that exist. Okay, so some of our research groups in our program are looking at this balance and trying to get a handle on it. I think it's more or less a solved problem. The unsolved problem is, what the hell happens here then? You've squeezed the sponge, you've gotten the water out effectively, produced a lot of little earthquakes, and then they come back even bigger than before at greater depth. I should probably just stop and let you tell me why, because we don't really know why. My last 15 minutes, I do want to go over three kind of concepts for how to solve this enigma. And I'll do them very generally, because they all have kind of lots of details. But I'll cluster them into three groups. One we're going to call dehydration embrittlement, which is fluid-assisted faulting. Okay. Gonna have the same notion that there is some sort of fluid coming out, filling little tensional cracks, reducing the pore pressure or increasing the pore pressure and allowing brittle failure to occur. But probably not water, because you've squeezed that sponge already. There's nothing generating a lot more water. Unless there were hydrous phases that form at fairly low pressure in the intermediate depth zone that can then transport down to the transition zone. We call this region of all these phase transitions the transition zone between 410 and 660. Maybe some forms of water can get down there and then go unstable, and you have the same process. Problem solved if that's the case. So what is the water budget? Or is there something else, maybe some other form of rock type that might give up its volatiles at pressures and temperatures corresponding to the transition zone, even though it was stable throughout the shallower range? We'll talk about a couple of those ideas. The other one is transformational faulting. Now, you probably have heard about this if you've had Harry Green come and talk here at KITP. Transformational faulting is a mechanism that's going to be associated with dissolving to spinel transition. Okay. And then the third and last one will be thermal, I always call it catastrophe, but thermal runaway. Okay. First, dehydration embrittlement, the idea that there is some hydrous phase or some other phase that gets down to these depths. The observational constraints are that it must go unstable primarily below 550 kilometers, because that's where this number of earthquakes comes back up significantly. It's also where the biggest earthquakes occur. Now, we do know that at these depths, there's resistance to the slab going down. And this should be providing compression. So the slab is in more or less uniaxial compression along its dip at great depth, pretty much like that. And there is deviatoric stress. There's no problem to come up with plenty of stress to drive faulting because of the loading from above as the slab is coming in, the resistance from below, ambient flow, the difficulty of penetrating into what may be higher viscosity material down here. No problem to have a sufficient stress budget to produce earthquakes. The problem is to get them to occur brittly rather than just ductile mechanisms dominating. So dehydration embrittlement, it's going to be taking these cracks and filling them with a fluid. Now, that could be water, if water can get down there. And so I hope that our phase equilibria can map out the real stability of all water-bearing hydrous phases, not just those that go unstable at shallower depth in the transition zone. Can carbonates lose their carbon dioxide, lose carbon, or as indicated by some recent experiments, carbonates may melt. And a melt phase would work very well to fill those little open cracks and allow kind of classic shear failure with a fluid-filled crack system.
So there's one thing you haven't said. Which way to these deep earthquakes? What's known about which direction the fault's going? Vertical
or horizontal? It's pretty much all over the place. Some are activating faults that have the geometry here translated down, and they may be on horizontal or vertical geometries. Is a mix. The very biggest deep events are on either horizontal planes or vertical planes. There's not a simple systematic. In the intermediate zone, they also are difficult to relate to the geometries of faulting out here, unless you have faulting dipping away from the island arc or the subduction zone, because a lot of them rupture on horizontal planes. Okay, and I should say, they all look like shear failures. One possibility would be that in going through phase transitions, you should be changing the volume. Would there be an implosion of material? Seismologists have looked for this. There's only one candidate with any credibility at all for having a implosional component to the radiation of sound that came out from it. That's a recent earthquake in 2013. The largest earthquake we've seen, it's an 8.3, 600 kilometers deep. And it may have 1 to 2% isotropic implosional component. But otherwise, it looks just like shear faulting on a planar rupture. Okay, and we could talk about the four systems, but I don't think it's too important for this group. All right. So this is a possibility. It hasn't been ruled out. It is, after all, the preferred explanation for most shallow earthquakes and most deep, intermediate depth earthquakes. We just don't know if there is fluid getting down to the deeper zone to invoke it. But if we can find phase equilibria that allow the fluids to get there or melt in situ, then I think this is the best way to go, because it's what all other earthquakes in the world are caused by. Transformational faulting is associated with all of the ingoing to spinel, but it cannot be in this geometry. This stable form of transition cannot produce the earthquake, because that's all over at 410, and yet you have earthquakes at 680 kilometers deep. So the way people have argued is that this transition may be kinetically hindered so that it doesn't happen until much greater depth. Okay. Then you would have, and this is based on laboratory experiments, of squeezing olivine up very, very fast compared to the rate of plate subducting, and seeing it's still olivine when it's at higher pressure where it should have changed to wadsleyite. Okay. And then you can keep squeezing, and eventually it does change. And sometimes when it changes catastrophically, forming little shear cracks. Transformational faulting is associated with metastability then, where you have a phase change that should have happened here, happening much deeper in the Earth. And if you can get that olivine material down to these depths, it's still olivine. It's much lower density than the surrounding material. It's like a thin tongue of material within the plate that hasn't transformed. When it transforms, it could do so catastrophically. And it does so somewhat differently than this situation. I'll try to represent the same stress state that we have for dehydration and embrittlement. But in this case, you form little lenses of material that is transforming from olivine to spinel. And it's going to transform perpendicular to the principal stress axis rather than parallel to it. This is opening tensile cracks. This is forming dense features of spinel embedded within an olivine matrix, all of which is under some deviatoric shear stress. If you get enough of those little transformed pods of material to form, just as happens with tensional cracks, you could form a through-going crack parallel to the principal stress, shear stress axes. Okay? Transformational faulting. Now, it has been argued that this is the preferred mechanism for deep earthquakes. Many people, Harry Green in particular, would argue that that's a solved problem. He wrote that in Scientific America in 1994. So it must be true. We can test that idea. It's a weird idea, though, because you think, well, what controls whether you could have metastability? Does it exist in the Earth? In the laboratory, it makes sense. You squeeze things up really fast, you could get them to overshoot their stability domain. Does that actually happen in the Earth? If it does, I should have drawn this with a different color, you have this tongue of still olivine material. That's bounded by an isotherm, probably 600, 800 degrees. So it follows this tapering trajectory deep. But by the time you get down to where the very biggest deep earthquakes are, you can't have much of this left. And it's only going to be in the oldest or fastest sinking, coldest slabs that you could get this to have significant volume at depth. And there's not a simple relationship to how quickly slabs are sinking versus how big the deepest earthquakes are. Okay, so it's got some issues. Still, probably if we voted, I suspect in this room, most people in a confidential vote would probably say transformational faulting is the dominant mechanism because it's sort of been argued a lot. I think it's possible. I still would personally vote on this guy, even though we don't know anything, which is why I'd vote for, right? The last one is thermal runaway. And this is the idea that you actually go through these phase transformations as you change from olivine to spinel, you recrystallize this, the olivine grains, and it, you replace them with very tiny spinel grains in the lower temperature central core of the slab is transforming. So you end up with little spinel crystals surrounded by bigger ones in the surrounding mantle. And the argument is that you can have a temperature-dependent rheology then within this variable crystal size domain that leads to localization of shear within the fine-grained material. And that localization of shear produces heating, and it runs away because the heating further localizes the shear deformation by lowering the viscosity, and you can have a runaway process that leads to a possibly melting environment, but certainly a very localized, rapidly deforming environment. If that can actually break over into the acoustically radiating domain, it becomes an earthquake. Okay, so this is needs grain size to be right. It needs the temperature-dependent viscosity to be right. It needs to have the phase change to be giving the variation in grain sizes. We think the latter happens for sure. It should happen, though, right here. Well, we don't have any earthquakes. The big earthquakes are down here. Now, it is very possible that all three mechanisms can work together in various conditions. You may be able to stimulate the onset of shearing with a transformational faulting event that concentrates stress. You begin to slide, and that sliding process gives you thermal heating, localization, giving a runaway process. It's all coupled together, and these various mechanisms could work together. That may be necessary. Many details have been studied about earthquakes. And what I do is study the rupture process and the details of these, trying to measure their energy, their stresses, the change in stress, their geometries. And nothing has proved to be a smoking gun to distinguish between these mechanisms at this point in time. They all have problems explaining everything. The biggest problem is still the biggest earthquakes are here, and they can be whoppers. The Sierra Cuts event in 2013, it ruptured 200 kilometers at 9,000 miles per hour, just like a rupture going through glass. And to invoke these as the special conditions that enable that is still problematic. So I'll leave you with, I don't know what causes deep earthquakes, but they are a really good frontier topic to be investigating. Thanks a lot. It stops. This transition to perovskite is ubiquitous, and it will actually happen with all the minerals, including the basaltic components. This is endothermic. This transition is exothermic. It gives off heat, and that helps to perpetuate mechanisms like transformational faulting. When you go through this transition, which slabs would do if they directly penetrate, some appear to flatten and maybe slowly penetrate or just rely there, they don't have earthquakes at all below 700 kilometers. Okay? And it seems as though, unambiguously, the transition to perovskite is shutting down any of the available mechanisms. Okay, that's the most straightforward interpretation. Well, the most straightforward is that slabs don't go through that, but there's evidence that slabs can go through there, at least push it down.
What's the spatial scale into the
board? Thousands of kilometers.
But do you see it as having ripples, or do you see it as a flat sheet?
It's a very undulating surface. It really depends on the upper plate that you're converging with, the history of how motions have gone. Slabs are weak, but they are still stress guides. We know that the stresses can be communicated along the length of the slab, but they can also kind of wave and fold and buckle and tear. So they're not, you know, incredibly strong structures at great depth, but they still have structural integrity, and they're the strongest elements in the flow. They're driving the flow. There's no earthquake here. There's no earthquake outside of what can reasonably be attributed to downwelling slab material. There are isolated earthquakes. We might have earthquakes over here, but the general thinking is that they are due to the slab deflecting and having gone there. Or in the case of like earthquakes under Fiji, which are very isolated from current subduction zones, it's thought that that is relic of an ancient subduction zone where slab went down from a different geometry, and it's still producing earthquakes in the transition zone. But you don't have them. There's no 600 kilometer deep events under North America. Well, I mean, some of our groups are probably studying that. The question is how much goes in the lower mantle versus deflecting in the upper mantle. And there's a mix. Probably the majority of slab flux seems to at least ephemerally accumulate, deflect horizontally. There's a few cases where the slabs poke down pretty clearly, like the Marianas, where it just tomographically appears to extend to at least 1,100 kilometers or so. But I'd say the preponderance of slab flux does deflect. It's hard for it to get into this, and the deeper mantle may have additional viscosity mechanisms increasing with depth that resist it. But there are places where you definitely should have slab material, at least the thermal halo of the slab extending deeper, and you don't have earthquakes below 6-7. Yeah, I'll give you an idea of how rare. If we look at these shallow events for magnitude 8, there were 33 in this period, and there were 3 here. And there were 0 here.
And you said that only that one has a component of implosion.
It's unpublished. Yeah, of course. The two biggest events are 1994 Bolivia, 2013 Ciudad Cots. They're both 8.3, both extremely well recorded. Neither has a resolvable isotropic component from routine analysis. It's only detailed analysis of certain spheroidal modes that Emilio Call has detected some evidence for isotropic component of this guy. We tested it independently and found supporting evidence, but we haven't published it either because reviewers are brutal. Yeah. There's just no earthquakes in here, or there are very, very few. Water reservoir in the slab, if it were there, has to be such that these are stable phases in this depth range, and they only go unstable when you get deep. Well, in the surrounding transition zone, you do. But you also have a lot of phases within the deeper Hertzbergitic layer that as they transform, they like water. And you can soak up large amounts of water. So if it is released, it doesn't all have to evacuate the slab. It could be absorbed into A phase, B phase, C phase, D phase, that can then hold that water to greater depth. Now, I don't believe the equilibrium, the stability of all those has been established, whether some of them would go unstable at 650 kilometers and provide that a re-release of the water. But they're little sponges sucking up the water within the slab. And the problem is to measure their stability, their metastability, their ability to go abrupt and catastrophically release the fluid without the fluid being immediately absorbed into some other hydrous-loving phase. That's, I think, the mineral physicists will have to explain whether or not there's bounds on that right now. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as green relay, I don't know, but if it was dry, could it be the Watsonite, the green relay, liberating water to go back to the combination of one and two? Is that boundary about 550?
Yeah, that would be the depth at which you'd have it. It's right about the right depth to start kicking in a new mechanism. Yeah. So if hydrous Watsonite dehydrates, releasing water on a time scale and volume that could allow, number one, my favorite dehydration embrittlement to take place, maybe that would work.
I mean, are they got
Okay. Thank you very much.